This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Nashville, Tennessee. Right now, we're in Zach Brown's recording studio with Matt Mangano. This is really cool. This is kind of a mothership, isn't it?
It really is the mothership. Yeah, it's our mothership.
Tell us about the history. This was not purpose-built as a studio at all.
No, it was built originally as a church, built between 1897 and 1903, and it was called the Addison Avenue Cumberland Presbyterian Church. Once we took control of the building, I started doing some research to try and figure out what it was, and because there had been the stories that everyone had told about this place was that it was a Civil War hospital, which I think that's what they say about most old buildings in Nashville. But it was supposed to be a Civil War hospital, and they also said it might have been a morgue. And so I did some research in the city archives and found out that the building wasn't here until 1897. So someone had fudged a story somewhere along the lines. But that
could have been a previous building on the same lot.
That was another alternative, that there could have been a building here on this lot, or it was just a big empty field where they took, you know, wounded and dead soldiers. I don't know. And I'll never know. So 1897, this church decided to buy a property, and they describe it in their church logs. I found those online. They talk about this big, beautiful property up on the west end of Nashville that overlooks downtown. And
very different neighborhood, turn of the 20th century.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you could probably see all the way to the Cumberland River from here. I think they completed it in 1903, and the church existed until the 50s, I think. And then it became a halfway house. It was a VFW lodge at some point, and then in 1968, Fred Foster bought it, and Fred Foster was the head of Monument Records, so he bought this building to become his new studio. So they renovated it, and we found pictures of them, you know, black and white pictures of them bricking in where old stained glass windows might have been. Basically, back then, it was a big open room, so none of these sound booths, the isolation booths, were here.
But what's interesting, like you said, open, it truly is open. It's going way up two stories to a vaulted ceiling,
yeah,
beam ceiling.
At the peak here, it's about 35 feet. When we walked in, though, it looked different. Yeah, you're good. You can come on in. I've learned from Tom that ambient noise is good for podcasts.
Yeah, make noise.
Sounds like we're telling the truth. But when we came in here, it looked very different. The ceiling stopped at the bottom of those trusses, and there was a bunch of black fabric covering some really bad insulation.
Question for you. When you look in, this is the recording studio, Studio A.
This is Studio A, yep.
Yeah. So you have a whole band that would be set up right around us.
Mm-hmm.
But yet their sound can kind of float all the way up to a hard ceiling. So this is a very different atmosphere than a technical, optimal studio.
Right, yeah. And, you know, when we did the renovation in here, there wasn't a whole lot scientific about it. You know, we kind of just had a hunch that and hoped that it was going to work out sonically. So when we pulled down all the insulation and rebuilt the ceiling and exposed all the brick, all the brick was covered by plaster. The brick was hiding, and we brought it back to its glory. We were kind of taking a bet that it would work, but, you know, we know enough about audio just to be dangerous, but there's enough texture on the walls that it's more diffuse rather than reflective. So, but anyhow, we opened it up and it ended up sounding really nice.
So you lucked out.
We lucked out, but then also the most important component in the way it sounds, though, is how it's captured. So engineers who really know how to use this room can get a great sound. So Brandon, our engineer who runs the studio, he has microphones strategically placed in the building already that he can just sneak in if he wants to get a really big ambient room sound.
So he can pot up a remote mic far from a player.
Yeah, there's a couple hidden up there on the bricks already.
That's really interesting. I knew I was going to come here today for a few days, and so in my mind, you know, it's like, it's almost a mystery world. You understand when a band is on stage playing live, and, you know, you already dialed everything as much as you can, and you have somebody out front listening ahead of time, but then you just go for it and you do it. What happens, happens. When your band, for example, is in here recording, you can manipulate, you can post-production, adjust. Tell us about that tweaking world.
It's a rabbit hole, for sure, the tweaking world, because We've always been able to sort of tweak, you know, as far as technology would allow us, right? So in the early days of tape, you could still splice the tape. People were cutting out notches in multi-track tapes to try to edit this track but not this track.
And it was almost blind.
Blind, but we've got to work with some great tape engineers. I mean, it's an art as much as it is a science. But as technology has evolved, yes, the tweaking capabilities have increased a lot. Now, with digital workstations, the tweaking is infinite and endless. And so it kind of almost takes some self-discipline to not go that far. But us as a band, you know, there's eight of us, and we all, to some point, are engineers on our own. So we all kind of individually know how to can go in and tweak our own parts, and then Zach comes back and does the ultimate tweak, and then we'll think that we're done and ready to print this thing, and then there'll be more tweaking. And then that's just the editing process. Then you can go to mix. In the mixing process, it's just even more tweaking.
Do you ever manipulate in post-production on that atmospheric, the atmosphere that you're in, that overarching for everybody, to create kind of a concert hall?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the, you know, digital effects are so good now. They're so much better than they were 10, even 5 years ago. The ability to emulate rooms. I mean, there's some software out there where they've taken, it's called an impulse response, and they basically measure how a room will react across the frequency spectrum. Mm-hmm. And then they're able to put that into a software, and when you apply a sound to it, it's as if you were in that room. So you can be in like a concert hall in Vienna or in Ocean Way Studio down the street. I think someone just came in and did an impulse response of this room. So, you know, really it's not the same as being in that room, but it's pretty darn close. And you wouldn't, in the context of hearing a recording, you wouldn't ever know that it wasn't.
A few weeks ago, we were talking about you as a music writer and then laying down your music and then manipulating and adjusting and adding a drum beat or whatever. Does Zach Brown ever do a music cut and say two of the guys can't be there? So a couple guys would come into the studio and lay something down, and then subsequently the next musician would layer in later, not in the same time?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's called overdubbing. And so, you know, a lot of music is done that way now.
So in Zach Brown's studio, that for you guys, your band, that could easily happen.
Yeah, Zach Brown Band did that. Actually, on this last record, we had the first initial recording session, Zach wasn't here. Mm-hmm. He was in Los Angeles, and so he was working with a couple writers out there, songwriters. As they would write the song, they would also sort of make sort of a guide track that had, you know, might have a guitar, some programmed drums, and a bass or something like that. As they were writing, it's their music that they were writing to. And then the rest of us were here in this studio, just sort of waiting to get a song from Zach. They would send it over when they're done writing it, and we would start recording on top of what they did. Meanwhile, they're writing the next song while we're doing that. That was one of the ways that we did that. A common way that a recording session will happen with us is that we'll have the song written, we'll sit down and work it out, and then we come in to record. So we'll play the song, we'll record it maybe four or five times until it feels pretty good, and then we'll all go back and listen. Well, let's say that we're going to listen to take five. We just got finished with take five, and we're going to go listen to it. And I remember, well, in the second chorus of take five, I had a bad note, or I played something a way that I didn't like it. I'll say, you guys go and listen, and while you're listening, I'll tell the engineer, punch me in on the second chorus. They'll be listening down, and literally I'll go back and replay the second chorus in real time as it passes. And then, so that's one way that we can overdub. Another way is that we can, yeah, send the audio files to each other and record it in our own homes. We've done that before in other studios.
As we're sitting here in the studio, how many stations are there for performers? What, seven? Something like that?
We've had eight here, and there's been more. There's been a full string section in here before.
So you have seven or eight here that are performing simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Each one of their instrument stations is sucking in the sound, but there's cross-pollination, right?
Sure.
It's also picking up somebody else. So
yeah, you get some bleed, and that's, you know.
So my question is, then in post-production, if you're manipulating and tweaking, you have in that underbed of the guy next to you your sound that you want to change. That seems tough.
It can be. So what you would do either is you would have to eliminate that bleed, or you'd have to just embrace the the craziness. Yeah. So one thing I was going to mention is that this studio back in the late 60s, when Fred Foster owned it, none of these isolation booths were here. Mm-hmm. So the way that they would record a song is that everyone was in the room.
Right.
So the bass player was there, and they would set up sort of in, the engineers were so good that they would know the proximity to the microphones from the instruments that were going to cause bleed. What they would do is the microphone that's on the guitar amp was also sort of ambient room microphone for the drums. And they would just know that. They would know that there was going to be drums in the guitar, and they would plan for it. And then right up there on that platform, that was called the string porch. So they would have string sessions sometimes. You know, some of that old country had strings on it, a little string arrangement. You know, somewhere around the 70s, they started adding these isolation booths. Because the sound was changing. You know, people were wanting more isolation.
Would it be more voice for isolation or no?
Well, what happened is that the recording capabilities changed. So multi-track recording became a thing. Whereas in the 60s, you might have had two-track or four-track recording. In the 70s, eight-track came out. And so they said, oh, well, if we have eight tracks, we can isolate eight different instruments. And if we cut out all of this ambient bleed, then we can have more control. And that was when you saw engineers take more control of the music.
You and I were talking the other day about RCA Studio B, which is, 1950s technology. And so the fantasy question would be, what if you could pull those boys through time and have them record today? How different they would be.
I tell you what, there have been some sessions in here where we have been able to get those musicians from that era in here. And sometimes people try to recreate that. And so they'll all be sitting in a room, and it'll be just like it was before. But also, those guys have evolved over time. You know, to be a working musician, you have to keep up with the technology. You just have to. You don't have a choice. So if you're, a guy who never wanted to use headphones because you liked being in the room with everybody, and then you show up to a session where everybody's on headphones, you're going to be the odd man out, and you're not going to be able to hang. So I think adapting to technology and being flexible as a musician is a must. You can't be precious about the old ways.
Can we go and see the board?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, cool.
I was going to show you, so I was going to tell a little bit of a story, though, about this place. Is that when we came in here, it already had been a functioning studio. Mm-hmm. When I first walked in, it was like they had set up for a session and then left. It was almost like an abandoned studio. So all of these microphones were on stands, and there were these amazing vintage German microphones, Neumann microphones, that had just been left behind. I was going to show you. This is a Neumann U48 that was on the stands.
Nice.
And these were what the, whenever you saw a picture of the Beatles singing into a microphone, these are what they used. The 48s. So U47 is a pretty popular Neumann microphone.
And the 48, you ever pull those out and use them intentionally today?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, our engineers here, they know the characteristic of each microphone, and they'll pick the right one for the application. The reason the Beatles used these is because they had a figure eight pattern, so it was directional on either side of the capsule, so that one could be here and one could be here. So John's here, Paul's here.
Yeah.
Whereas the U47s had the Omni capsule instead of the figure eight. Yeah, there was all sorts of treasures hanging around in this building when I came in here.
Mm-hmm. So when did Zach take over the studio?
So in early 2012, he and I had started talking about going studio shopping. I was doing a lot of work for him, for his record label, out of my basement. So we decided it was time to kind of step it up a little bit. And he said, well, look and see what you can find in Nashville. So I started doing a real estate search, and I was putting in price parameters, just trying to find some small little bungalow over on Music Row that had a studio. And one day I accidentally forgot to put in the price parameter, and this place popped up. And I start clicking through the pictures, and I thought, oh my goodness, look, they have everything that we would need to buy
already there
to build a studio, to stock a studio, and it's already here. So I came to look at it, and the place had sat vacant for 2 years. They were trying to sell it, and they couldn't sell it for whatever reason. So I came and checked it out and called Zach and said, hey, you should come look at this place. So he did, and walked through it and just fell in love with it. It had everything we needed, and the vibe was, it had the wood, this is Pecky cypress wood here on the walls. This is the old wood that had been pulled out of a swamp. And that wooden sort of earthy vibe was really...
Well, even it's interesting, the Pecky little indentations probably work nice acoustic baffles to a point.
Again, it's sort of that diffusion idea. So you know, it's soft in the little crevices here, but it's hard and reflective on the outside. So a combination of surfaces is ideal. Yeah, that's kind of how this place started. You know, it had been a studio since 68, and it was almost like they never threw anything away since 1968. So you'll see when we go up to the shops, it's been like audio archaeology.
How cool.
Since day one.
So this was definitely meant to be.
Yeah, I think so.
And like you said, that it just sat on sold. Nobody figured it out and picked it up.
It's no
kind
one
of a,
did.
And, kind of and, a miracle.
And now it's, you know, it's sort of a super hot spot for real estate around Nashville. And we were surrounded by a field and a two-story buildings of the same era across the street. And now we're surrounded by apartments, high-rises, hotels, parking structures. This is all in the span of 5 years. Here, what else can I show you while we're still in here? This piano has been here since 68. It's a 10-foot Baldwin SD-10. There's a few of these in town, and this one, we're pretty sure it belonged to Liberace. He had a handful of pianos in town that he recorded with. And
does it ever come out of there?
It's only left the building one time, and that was when I moved it out when we redid the floors, which is actually another interesting story. These floors are made of... wood.
It almost looks cherry. What is the wood?
This is quilted sapele.
It's beautiful.
And the outside is Hawaiian koa. Mm-hmm. And then there's a stripe of Madagascar ebony right there under her feet. And this wood came from Taylor Guitars. So it was wood that was supposed to be made for guitars, but then apparently it was on a truck and the wood froze and then unfroze and froze again. And Taylor has super high quality standards for their wood, and so the fact that it froze on a molecular level made it unstable to use as guitar. So Zach and Bob Taylor had a great relationship, and Taylor milled the wood into flooring and sent it out here to be installed in this studio. So
that's double cool flooring.
Yeah, and we went right on top of the old... Speaking of archaeology, yeah. Every layer of floor in this building that has been here since 68 is still there. So beneath this is wood parquet floor. Underneath that is some linoleum tiles. Underneath that is asbestos tiles. Underneath that is the original oak plank floors. And then under that is the sub...
God, what a trip. It feels like concrete, man. It's so solid.
Yeah. And then they cut these... They laser cut these logos for us.
And tell us about the label there.
Yeah, Southern Ground. That was the name of Zach's record label. It's the name of this studio, Southern Ground Nashville. And it was sort of a concept that they came up with. It actually came from a line in the song Chicken Fried. It was raised on Southern Ground.
Chicken Fried is one of Zach Brown's top hits, right?
That's the biggest one, yeah, for sure. So it sort of became a brand. That's the story behind that.
And this upright behind you, that's ancient.
Yeah, that one, I don't know where that one came from. That was actually, it might have been a piano rescue that we found, and it just has a really cool, different, you know, almost parlory sound. Whereas that, the bald one's real beautiful, you know, this one's really in a real honky-tonk. Actually, all of these keyboards were here, too. This was another piece of the gold mine. This, you have a 73 Rhodes, you have a Hohner clavinet, got a Hammond B3, which was once owned by Greg Allman.
Wow.
Another legend is that Allman Brothers recorded a record here in the 70s, and then for some reason that he left the organ as payment. Mm-hmm. And then we have a Wurlitzer piano, electric piano here.
That's pretty cool. That's
these are all, you
that's
know,
ancient, huh?
Can't hear that one, but they must. Yeah. So the instruments came with the building. We've added a lot more instruments to the building.
Why did they basically just walk away?
So it was owned by Al Jolson Jr. At that time it was called MasterLink Studio. And Mr. Jolson became ill, and then, you know, the people managing his estate, I think, decided that it was time to let it go. So yeah, they had to shut it down so they could sell it. But, you know, we found artifacts from all eras of the studio, because it was So it was Monument Studio, and then it got sold to a guy named Chip Young, and it was called Young & Sound. At some point, a co-owner was Scotty Moore, who's Elvis's guitar player. It was called Studio One after Young'un, and then it became MasterLink.
You do know, some point in the future after we're gone, this might be some legendary museum.
Hopefully we'll leave it in good enough shape to where they won't have to do all the digging that we did. If you look up here, way up in the corner, we'll see them when we go up there, but there's a couple like look like white hands sitting on top of that bookshelf.
Yeah.
Those were the front of the building when it was MasterLink, and they lit up, and they were the jazz hands, the Al Jolson jazz hands.
God, what a trip. Al Jolson Jr., man. Legend going back early 20th century.
Yeah, absolutely. Up here, you see all of these tapes. Mm-hmm. Those are all analog tapes that were left behind. So there's a closet upstairs next door.
Has anybody archived them to figure out what's up?
I did, yeah. Well, we haven't listened to them all, but there's...
But you know the subject.
There's at least 1,000 tapes.
Wow.
And they were just sitting in this closet collecting dust and rat poop, and it was, and they're in a bad shape. So we were trying to figure out what to do with them because we were renovating that room. I decided that we had to save them somehow. So let's use them for decoration or something. We brought them all down here. We laid them out on tables. This room was filled with tapes stacked on tables, and we went through each one, and we transcribed whatever text was on there, and I made a database of all the, you know, specs about each tape. So we don't know what it sounds like on them, but we know what's on all of them.
But
so if somebody ever reaches out saying, hey, we were there in 84, do you have this? And we can say yes or no.
There could be some legend up there, man. It's lost.
I got something that I'll show you later on when we're off the tape. Yeah, so that was a big project, but I'm glad that we did that and didn't just send them to the dumpster.
Well, the question for you is degradation of tape. And at some point,
right,
there's going to be dust in there.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So I think there's some of them that need to get transferred, and some of them are just going to be, you know, that happened then. Mm-hmm. And
well, let's take a look and
see. Yeah, let's go in the control room.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
All right.
We have about 10 minutes left.
Oh, do you? Okay.
We have to go to the airport and pick people up.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Oh, that's my homeland right there, man. I'm Pro Tools, dude.
Yeah. This is actually all a bunch of tapes.
Uh-huh. I'm
about to get back into transferring them.
This is Dan Davis.
Dan, hi.
Hey, yeah.
So, you're an engineer?
Yeah. I'm the primary assistant here. Cool. Engineering, making things happen. These are a bunch of tape transfers we've been doing. I'm just kind of bouncing them out so that we can put them online and send them to the client, and they can peruse through them in a way that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Instead of just tape numbers.
Yeah, I spent hours and hours in Pro Tools land.
Yeah, that's kind of what you go to sleep mm-hmm. seeing.
So is Pro Tools your favorite?
I do like Pro Tools. I use a lot of Ableton at home. Mm-hmm. I think it's really conducive to being creative and making things really fast and on the fly. Mm-hmm. And its audio engines are really smart. Yeah. And its time warping properties are really, really good. And so when you're writing or just making things for fun, it's really easy to just click it while the whole song is playing and listen to it slower or listen to it faster, mm-hmm. things like that. Whereas Pro Tools is great if you're using a large format multi-track console and doing tape or digital, and it's very beneficial for all that. And editing and finishing out projects makes a lot of sense to me in Pro Tools. But
so now here to your right, you have the Mothership board.
Yeah,
but
yeah, Legacy Plus, mm-hmm. 48 channels. We have a really cool custom 500 series options bucket, which is nice. So you can just drop your 500 series gear right in.
And how much do you actively use the board when you're producing versus on the computer?
Here we use the board a lot. It's heavily used. In our 200 options spots, we have like the filters in the first eight. So obviously that's like where the drums would be. Those are really useful, as well as the 550Bs. They all get a ton of use. We have incredible selection of outboard gear. So obviously there's a lot of like kick, snare, and Neve action and things like that. But people love the board. it's really easy to convince people to stay there. It's just right here in front of you. You stay in the stereo field, and it's just a quick turn, and it really can do a lot of things.
It's really great to be able to work on a console. These days, not a lot of engineers get to even do that. Most people are sitting in front of a computer, and which is great. That's the way it's gone. But to be able to sit behind a console and actually not look at a screen, interact with the musicians, and put your hands on knobs and turn them, it really, even if you can't hear the difference on the end, it helps you when you're involved in the process to feel like you're part of the music. The consoles do something. You know, they bring all the music together, and it kind of creates this musical stew, you know, where all these, you know, 24, 48 different signal paths come in and combine down to two.
Your VU meters, how much do you look at those?
I'd say the engineers use them all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's because you're not able to focus individually on every single thing at every single time, every step of the way.
They're almost like little lie detectors, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, like certain instruments, you're okay if you're going in the red once in a while, but if it's a drum, then, you know, you might be getting some clipping. So, you know.
And you can't heal clipping, can you? It's pretty
much. A little bit.
Tom, you can do anything nowadays.
I love the meter. I use the meters a lot.
Yeah.
And I stress out when I can't see them. Mainly a lot of my job happens on the edge because there is an engineer here.
Oh, right.
And he's not looking at the computer and I'm handling all of that. But I can see what's happening on the board and be able to tell if noise is what I think it is or...
Looks like it's picking you up now.
I was checking. I was actually just, when you started talking about them, I'd muted them, but I was turning them on to see how loud this is. Yeah. It's a little soft, but I was turning it up, and so I just wanted to see where the meters were. It's kind of ironic.
There was a record we did a few records ago called The Girl Sessions, and we were all analog, all console, no screen. So, and it was one of the first times in my life where I had ever worked, I mean, first time in a long time where I had... There was no screen to look at. You were just listening to the music. That was it. Not distracted by any lights except these little flashing lights here. Totally different way of working.
Okay, trust me. Royal Studios.
Okay.
Field trip.
Do you know Royal Studios?
Memphis.
Man, yeah. That's Boo Mitchell's place.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
See?
Man, that's a cool spot.
Shouldn't he go there?
You
check
should.
It out, yeah.
You feel like you should wear a mask because it's all exposed, like old
insulation.
Just like
the fiberglass stuff.
It's a really sweet spot. Man, a ton of incredible records were made there.
Yeah, he did Bruno Mars.
Yeah.
One, yeah. Major legend.
Yeah, yeah.
Hal Green.
Oh, really? Yeah. Was that where they cut all
where they did all that stuff.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
See?
Love and Happiness?
Don't go uninvited.
Okay.
You want the door to be unlocked when you get there.
Okay.
and his mom hanging
Noted.
Out there. Anyway, let's go wrap,
because
she's going to get mad at me.
All right.
I'm not going to get mad at you. You know who's going to get mad
at
me.
Yeah. You want to show secret stuff up here.
Secret secret stuff. There's no end to this studio.
Very cool.
That's kind of how it used to be, though, when I would come in here at 8 and 9 in the morning, and I wouldn't go home until 3 a.m. because there's so much. I mean, we haven't even seen the workshop yet, but it was just, you know, 40, 50 years worth of audio equipment, parts, and old back issues of Mix Magazine. The one rule that I made was you can't throw anything away unless you know what it is and you know you don't need it. That's right.
And that's Zach, too, same.
Kind of the same mentality, because, you know, I mean, there's just things out there. You know, one man's trash is another man's treasure, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was all these old issues of magazines, audio magazines, and we were going to throw them away, but then the plaster in the ceiling was falling down. And one of our builders had this idea, well, what if we tore pages out of this magazine and like, put polyurethane all over it and use it to hold up the plaster? And literally, that's what it's doing up in the shop.
So, it's called living history.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. Okay, you know all the secrets.
If you want to know more secrets, just call me.
Here we are at the mothership.
Here we are at the mothership. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I would just say that I'm really thankful to be able to be involved in a place like this. This studio in particular is my baby, you know. I mean, we really transformed it into what it is now. We took it from, you know, it was already built up. It was already, it had a lot of history to it. We definitely transformed it to fit our style and our needs, and now it's open to the public. Anyone can come book the studio, and experience it and, you know, use our instruments, use our equipment, and make their own history.
I love it. For further information, somebody wanted to learn more about the studio.
You can email info@southerngroundnashville.com.
What a great morning. Thank you for sharing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now we got to come up with a plan number three.
That's right.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Nashville, Tennessee. We've been visiting with Matt Mangano, bass player in Zach Brown Band. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Get away for a good time. I got good news. That's what me and the boys and the band were born to do. You can spend your whole life however you see fit. Riding at a desk, digging in a ditch. Whose ass you gotta kiss? So come on now, jump right in. Cause life goes by so fast. How many summers do you have left before you're pushing up? Take the weight of the world and lift it right up off of you. It's just what we do. You got a broken heart, you just need to get away for a good time. I got good news. That's what me and the boys in the band were born to do.
Take the weight of the world and lift it right up off of you. It's just what we need.